Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, everybody. This is Ali Milani on Politics Uncensored at FUBAR Radio. I'm joined in the studio with my co-host, Zoe Grunewald, political journalist, broadcaster and commentator. And we have a big show in this election period. Joining us later will be Olivia Lever, director of Blue Beyond, and Fiona McGowan, former Labour member who was expelled from the party in 2022, and Sharon Gafgar, political activist and former Love Island contestant. They will all be joining us later to talk about various stories headed into a general election. But before we get into that, we go into the Week Unwrapped, where we talk about the big stories of the week. And it was mostly about Labour this week, Zoe.
It was. It's been a big week for Labour, but not in the way they might want. So while they've been trying to talk about their campaign pledges, their plans for tax, their plans for the NHS, it's been massively overshadowed by another factional row in the Labour Party. This started with the culmination of the investigation into Diane Abbott. She was given the whip back only for somebody within the party to brief to the Times that she was not going to be allowed to stand as a candidate at the general election in Hackney.
Yeah, so Diane Abbott has accused Labour of carrying out a cull of left-wingers after she and others were blocked or dissuaded from standing for the party. The veteran Labour MP vowed on Wednesday to stay on for as long as it is possible after a deal for her to retire from Parliament broke down. The row, which has angered and frustrated a lot of Labour MPs and staff members, escalated on Thursday after two left-wing candidates were also blocked from the party and general election. Faiza Shaheen, who was Labour's candidate up until last night in Chingford and Wood Green, she spoke to BBC Newsnight last night about her treatment and the way that she had been blocked. And Lloyd Russell Moyle MP, who had been the MP for Brighton Kemp Town since 2017, announced that he'd been suspended from the party on Wednesday afternoon and would not be allowed to stand at the next election. On Thursday morning, Darren Jones, the Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, denied that it was a factional issue. Asked on Times Radio where Labour was purging the left, he said, "I don't think that's true. I mean, there are many colleagues of mine in the Parliamentary Labour Party who would define themselves as being on the left, who are endorsed by the Labour Party and candidates standing in their constituencies." Responding to the news on Twitter, Abbott said, "Appalling. Whose clever idea was it to cull of left-wing members? I'm not even going to dignify Darren Jones's bold-faced lie with a response." Before we get into the individual cases, because I suspect we're going to want to talk about Diane's case and Faiza Shaheen's case particularly, let's talk about the politics of it all. We're in a general election campaign. Labour were 20, or still probably are, 20 points ahead in the polls. The Tory campaign had collapsed, starting in the rain and, campaign events opposite the Titanic. So all was going well for Labour. Why on earth would they purposely erupt this row during a general election campaign? Is there any logic to it?
No, it's a really good question, because there's such a strong argument that says just sit back, enjoy the ride and watch the Tories eat themselves. And yet Labour cannot seem to ever step away from this factional infighting that's haunted the party for decades and decades. So we know that the Labour Party, like most political parties, is a broad church. There are people who are far more of the left in there. There are people who are far more kind of the right or of the centre. And then you've got the factions extend to the unions as well. And we know that Keir Starmer is now seen as far more kind of centrist, more towards the right of the party. But there's just so many questions about... I think Starmer wants discipline within the party. He wants a party that's going to back him, that's going to see him into number 10 and is going to support his policy. And for a while now, there have been accusations from the left of the party that Starmer's deliberately been purging it of left-wing influence. So the centre of the Labour Party has been stitching up candidate selections, parachuting candidates they think are going to be loyal to Starmer in, and removing those who they think might be more troublesome. But this has culminated in Diane Abbott, who's one of the most long-standing MPs. She's iconic. You know, she's the first female black MP in Parliament. now being caught up in this row, which quite frankly has gone on for far too long. You know, the investigation into her was launched, I think, over a year ago even. And now it's erupted this whole new row as well. And people just say, you know, doesn't, even if you don't agree with Diane Abbott's politics, at least you would treat her with a degree of respect here, considering her history. And then, of course, Pfizer as well, who is this, she was candidate for Woodford. And she is furious because she, you know, she's wants to understand why she's now been deselected at the last possible moment.
Yeah, so I'm curious about the reasoning behind this, because, like you said, they look, you would think Keir Starmer has complete control of the party now. No one would question that. And Labour was sat very, very comfortably. But the wall-to-wall coverage over the last sort of 24 to 48 hours has mostly been on Diane, now a little bit on Faeser, mostly on Labour's internal factional issues. Labour announced some NHS plan yesterday. It didn't get any coverage at all or any liftoff at all because everyone was talking about this. Is that, before I want to talk about the substantive cases themselves, but do you think, could this have an electoral consequence at all for them, or...
I think a lot of people have been quite upset by Diane Abbott's treatment. I think, you know, already the Labour Party was annoying or upsetting parts of its core vote. So particularly kind of the progressive parts of their vote, students and the BAME community, who were really disappointed by the party's approach to the war in Gaza, who have been upset at the party backing away from some of its more progressive green policies. But then seeing the treatment of a sort of... older female black, you know, MP in this way, I think has upset a lot of people. There are quite a few black historic Labour voters who are now saying, I'm not sure if I can vote for this party because I perceive it to possibly be racist now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether all those votes will add up and actually dramatically reduce Labour's poll lead, I don't know. I would imagine it's going to be far too spread out across the country to actually make a dramatic difference in particular seats. I think a lot of people will still, at the end of the day, go to the ballot box, and even if they're holding their nose, they'll vote Labour because they just want the Tories out. But I think the big problem for the party is what this does to them when they're in government and how this comes back to bite them in a few years' time. At some point in government, Labour is going to need the left of their party. They're going to need them on side for a particular policy. And these kind of things haunt the Labour Party. They don't let it go. So even if it's not troublesome now, it doesn't mean it won't be troublesome in the future.
So I want to talk about this issue of allegations of racism, because Diane Abbott's treatment from the story that you hear is horrendous. I mean, there's the actual... case of potentially blocking her and barring her. There's the questions about Starmer's honesty, because he has said on multiple occasions, including two key interviews with LBC, one with Nick Ferrari and one with Lewis Goodall, where he said explicitly that the process was ongoing. That was in February and March, as it relates to Diane. We now know that it was concluded in December, and there is no way the leader of the Labour Party didn't know that. So there's the substantive case on that. There's the questions around Faeser Shaheen. She said that one of the reasons that she was given was a tweet in which she outlines personal cases of Islamophobia that she's experienced and her own experiences of that. And the overarching thing we're hearing from Diane, from Faeser, and many people across the party is that minorities are treated differently. Mm. And the best example of that I can give are people like Neil Coyle, who have had very serious allegations against them, which have been upheld, and other MPs, one of whom made an anti-Semitic joke around Shekels, who apologized and no further action was taken. So on one side you have two white men who have made mistakes and apologized, and disciplinary action has been taken against them, but been swiftly dealt with, and they've been allowed to run. And on the other end, we've got two women, ethnic minority women of color, who have made mistakes. Some might say nowhere near on the scale of Neil Coyle, for example, but we don't want to play that game of, you know, of what's worse, but they're being treated substantially differently. And that's what I'm hearing. Mm. I mean, when I spoke to Faeser last night, I'm sure she won't mind me saying this, the only thing she said to me last night was double standards. Mm. We're treated differently. Mm.
And I think that's absolutely the case. And I think as well, if you look at the party welcoming Natalie Elphick in with open arms, a woman who mocked victims of sexual assault and who has been very outspoken and right-wing on immigration, who has been very dismissive of improving workers' rights, all fundamentally quite anti-progressive things that she said. She's been welcomed in with open arms. Meanwhile, Pfizer and Diane, both who have done a huge amount of work for their local communities, who have got stories of adversity that are really extraordinary. You know, if you read about their history, you would say, thank goodness we have people like this in politics. Mm-hmm. It does seem like a double standard. And the only way to explain it is, you're right, skin colour does seem to be a factor. But the other thing is how loyal they are to Starmer.
Yeah. And that does seem to be a key. And I wanted to tell you this. So, you know, we're talking about Neil Coyle and we're talking about others that have gotten away with it. Here are five of the most ridiculous reasons and the most blatant factionalism in where candidates have been blocked. So we've got Lauren Townsend, who was blocked, amongst other things, but principally for liking a tweet when Nicola Sturgeon said she had recovered from COVID, and that was used as a reason to block her. Doina Cornell from Stroud is a council leader and was told that she wasn't fit. They weren't fit to be a Labour Party MP. Lee Drennan, who's a big trade unionist and campaigner, and I believe was a local mayor, was blocked from running for signing a petition in 2016. Mish Rahman sits on the Labour Party NEC. He helps make the rules, and apparently he's not fit to be a Labour Party MP. Maya Evans in Hastings, who's a peace campaigner, was blocked for supporting, you know, local, working with the Green Party locally to get things done at a local level. So you've got council leaders, you've got members of the Labour Party NEC, you've got mayors who had just been told they're not fit. They're fit to run local government, they're fit to be mayors, they're fit to write to the laws that the Labour Party follows, but not fit to be MPs. Mm. And what can you say? The only reason, the only logical reason that you can give other than institutional racism is you haven't kissed the Starmer ring.
Mm. Absolutely. How else can you conclude from those stories? And I think what's really concerning to people is, I think a lot of people tell themselves, voters included, members of the party, they say, we just have to get elected. The public are broadly centrist. We can't do things that are too alarming or too radical. We just have to get elected. And then when we're in government, we can make arguments to be more progressive.
Yeah.
But all these things are adding up. And I think people are starting to go, well, hang on. Maybe things aren't going to get more progressive, because actually maybe Starmer's Labour,
yeah,
is exactly what you see. It's you know, it doesn't take well to too many opposing views. It wants loyalty to the centre.
And here's my problem. Look, we've spoken a lot on this show about the quality of the politicians that we get in. And ultimately, this seems to be a real problem in British politics. The quality of the human beings we're sending to Westminster is not good. We see that in the number of sexual harassment and assault cases that are coming out of Westminster. We see that in the number of racism cases that come out of the Westminster. We also see that generally in the quality of our politics, which I think everyone around the country will say is not good enough. And ultimately, that's because of the people that we're sending to Westminster. So people might think that this is a sort of internal factional issue and they might not care about it. But is this not, I mean, we're talking about fundamentally the kind of people we're sending to Westminster. And if we're saying the sort of the white men who kiss the ring are treated preferably and sent to Westminster, and if you're black, if you're brown, if you're a woman, if you're LGBT, you're facing a different standard, you're unlikely to be chosen, you find it much more difficult to be sent to Westminster. That's reflected in our politics.
Absolutely. And I think most people think that they hope that the left or the Labour Party or politics with the left leaning would be above that kind of boys club mentality. Mm-hmm. But I think what we're seeing and what we're hearing coming out of this, particularly around the decision-making centre of the Labour Party, the group of individuals who make these decisions and assert them, a lot of people are saying this is a boys' club. Mm-hmm. And something I find...
Do you think Labour gets away with it because it's Labour?
I think people don't expect it from the Labour Party, but it actually characterises a lot of left-wing politics. Mm-hmm. The boys' club is actually integral to a lot of, as you say, Westminster, a lot of politics, and the left is no different.
Yeah.
And I think...
I keep interrupting you, but I want to make clear that when we talk about the left, we talk about the entire left, by the way, because this boys' club issue, and I'll say particularly this white men issue, like where they have disproportionate control and we are held, I think, anyone from a minority or women are held to a different standard, existed in what I would, the sort of Corbynite left as well as as Starmer's. It's a different scale now, I'll say that for sure. But
no, I'm sure. And, you know, I've worked in left-wing media and it's been an issue there. It really is a thing that a lot of people talk about. And the thing that I find concerning is Starmer is resting a lot of his campaign on being trustworthy, being accountable, being transparent, putting that clear water between him and the Tories, who have been absolutely beleaguered by scandal and sleaze over the past 14 years. This stuff completely undermines that. If you are allowing a sort of unruly group of men to make decisions without accountability, how can anyone trust that you're going to drain the swamp, sort out Westminster?
So we have to move on, but I just want to ask you one quick question specifically about Diane. That seems to be the main story right now, whether Diane's going to be allowed to run. Starmer himself has said no decision has been made. Today, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner, said she thinks that Diane should be allowed to run. Supposedly, a decision is coming within the next 24 hours. Do you think they're going to let her run?
Yes, and I think it's going to be a very embarrassing climb down, and hopefully we'll have Labour and those individuals reflecting on the kind of briefings they're putting out. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they'll let her run?
No.
You don't?
What I'm seeing from the Labour Party and from the NEC and from key decision makers is a vengeful, spiteful, ruthless sort of streak that I don't think belongs in any work environment, let alone the highest standards of public office. And I think they don't care. I think they think they're going to win the election and they will eliminate as many people that were even remotely associated with the Corbyn project out of spite, out of anger. And they don't care if one of those people that they are now targeting is a trailblazer, the first black woman MP, someone who is the reason why so many, particularly people of minority communities, looked up to come into politics. I think I just don't think they care. And my frustration is I actually don't think the media cares that all that much. And I think if Diane gets blocked, it'll be a story for a hot moment to people. People will move on. But we'll talk about this next week and we'll see. One of us will be right. I desperately hope that you're right. But we're going to shift away from Labour and talk about the Conservatives, because it hasn't been a quiet week since our last show for the Conservatives either. They have been announcing policy after policy, including a triple lock plus on pensions and national service, the reintroduction of national service. And the Conservatives have decided to reintroduce this policy. And we're going to talk to Olivia Lever, Director of Blue Beyond, about this policy next.
FUBAR Radio presents The
Dating Show. So we have got the incredible Sunita.
How does Sunita whittle down the people she wants to talk to the people she doesn't? What's your criteria?
Well, you've got to be an adult.
Okay.
That's always a good start.
Always a good start. But when I'm an adult, not just like 18, you've got to be like not young enough to be my child. You have to ideally be London-based, because I am. Yeah. Although I don't mind if you've got a country pad, that would be nice.
So at the minute we're going with age and location are important.
Age and location are good.
Every Friday from 6 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back to Politics Uncensored. Ali and Zoe in the studio. For those wondering why I sound like I'm about to drop a country album, I'm recovering from some illnesses, and it looks like Zoe is about a week behind me, so you might sound like me.
Yeah, I'm slowly coming down with something, so by the end of the show, who knows?
Better the beginning of the general election campaign than the end. Great. But the campaign is fully underway, and we're getting policy after policy being announced by the Conservative Party, probably in a hope to overturn a big poll deficit. And they have now introduced or planned to reintroduce national service. The scheme would involve 30,000 selective military placements where the brightest and the best, quote, volunteers would get involved in cybersecurity, logistics or civil response operations full time for a year. Everyone else would do 25 days or one weekend a month for a year, with non-military organizations including fire, police, the NHS or charities. Joining me now to talk about this, I'd call it controversial policy announcement, is Olivia Lever, Director of Blue Beyond. Olivia, thank you so much for joining us. What's your initial reaction, particularly to the announcement around national service?
Oh, thanks for having me on, guys. Yeah, I think so our membership runs from 16 to 30, so it's not necessarily the people that will be directly impacted straight away. We don't necessarily reach that young, but it's just so poorly thought out. It's just, no, there's so many questions around the funding of it as well. It's allegedly going to cost $2.5 billion, with some of the money coming from other pots, other public spending pots, such as the UK Shared Prosperity Fund. And then also the government have turned around and said, oh, well, we're going to raise the money through cracking down on tax avoidance. But what does that actually mean? How much is that going to cost in itself? And the communications beyond around it are just beyond insulting, is what our members have said. You know, these are the kids that have sacrificed hugely in terms of socially and educationally through lockdown. You know, that was our service to communities, to make sure that those who were elderly or were had disabilities or were ill, you know, were protected from COVID-19. And now the government is just chucking that back in our faces, basically. So our members are really not very supportive of this policy at all.
And this, along with the Triple Luck Plus, seems like the Conservatives are really putting up two fingers to young people and saying, we're not interested in your vote. We're going to bank heavily on the over 50s vote, really. Because you'd imagine that the reintroduction of National Service is something that might get cheers from the older population as a sort of nostalgia of years gone by, with which, by the way, none of these older generation, I think, are old enough to have participated in conscription National Service. Well, at least most of them won't be, particularly the MPs. The triple lock to pensions is clearly a signal to older voters. Have the Tories completely given up on the young?
Yeah, I think what we are seeing from this election is that there is a complete neglect, and I would almost use the term ignorance towards younger voters. We're not in any form of political parties forefront of mind. Nobody's come out and put any really radical policies towards that would help young people. But yeah, our 75% of our members, we put our latest set of polling in the field last night, and 75% of our members said that they don't support this policy, and 45% said that they want to scrap the triple lock completely out of the next manifesto. So yeah, we're really seeing this kind of ignorance and neglect.
And can I just read you out a YouGov poll that was most recently published, the voting intentions of 18 to 24 year olds: Labour at 65%, up 9 points, Greens at 20%, up 16 points, and the Conservatives sit at 4%, down 17 points.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising at all. It's really not surprising. And what we do at Blue Beyond is that we acknowledge that not all young people are going to be Conservative. That's quite natural. But some our members, you know, joined the party, certainly during the Brexit years, where, you know, politics was really quite interesting for young people. And now, certainly probably coming out of the pandemic, we're just thinking, what is the offering to young people at all? And certainly, you know, speaking to friends of mine that are not necessarily in the political spectrum, a lot of them aren't really satisfied with Labour either. And now we're really thinking, well, why should I bother going and vote at all?
Olivia, under the Tories, there have been a raft of policies that I would say are not only ignoring young people, but actually quite destructive. So we've seen funding for youth services cut by more than 60% since 2010. We've seen tuition fees tripled. We've seen the departure from the EU, which has locked us out of things like Erasmus. We've seen mental health waiting lists for children rise to an extraordinary number, stagnant wages, a housing crisis, extortionate rents. I mean, how is it that you can still support this party?
So a lot of our members join the party under the principles of what the party was initially standing for, which was house building, business, growth, ambition, and all those things. And they are now sitting there and saying, you know, this is a struggle. We polled our members and said, how many of you are willing to go out and campaign? And 50% of them said, I don't want to go and campaign in this election. So, you know, the party really does need to kind of buck up its ideas. And I always use the analogy of Jamie Oliver took away millennials' turkey Twizzlers when they were all at school. And then when they got a little bit older and they had their own disposable income, none of them went and ate at his restaurants. And the Tory party is going to see the exact same thing if they carry on the way that they're going. They're not just going to annihilate younger voters now, but they're going to alienate them in 10, 15, 20 years, which will also lead to another plethora of issues for them as a party.
what sort of, so you, you spoke about house building. What sort of policies would you like to see from the next Conservative administration? You know, what are your big asks that could, you think could bring back a raft of young support for the Tories?
So our top three policies that our members want to see is an increase in house building, whether that be liberalising planning laws or changing the way that we build things so it's easy to build houses and it's an increase in supply. Our members are quite happy with the investment in nuclear power, whether that be maintaining it or increasing it. And then also reforming the NHS so that, for example, I know you quoted there saying mental health waiting lists, you know, they, those problems, for example, women's health issues are the issues that tend to affect younger people more generally. So that's really what our members want to see is reform of the NHS. Mm.
Isn't that quite close to what Labour's offering, though? I mean, I've been quite critical of Labour and the lack of policies. But you talked about liberalising planning laws. Labour have very specifically said that. Reforming NHS, I mean, I disagree with it, but Wes has talked about using the private providers to cut down waiting lists, which I assume, you know, your organisation would maybe be in favour. So given that Labour has shifted to the right, why is it not more attractive to you?
I think, to be honest, it's just...
Is it because it's red? Tell the truth.
Not necessarily, no, but I think it's that trust. And I think it's kind of looking at Labour and thinking, are they a government in waiting? Which I think a lot of people are looking at. For example, if you look at the last 24 hours and seeing how Diane Abbott's been treated, how Pfizer, she's at, I feel like I've just butchered her name, poor woman, has been treated. So, and just various bits of stuff that have gone on, for example, publishing the business list with people, some people's names who were dead, for example, and all those things. So I think in principle, also what our members want to see is there's that long-term goal. Will these plans actually work as well, for example? And also I know Labour have spoke about, you know, kind of making NHS staff members work at weekends and extending their hours, but now we're seeing lots of strikes as well. So it's really, how is that actually going to work? Our members don't really see it adding up. I think that is why, and that is probably why they'll just stay at home rather than go and switch to Labour. We're not seeing a switch to Labour in our polling at all.
That's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of people would say that, and a lot of Conservative voters would say, actually, the Conservatives have lost their trust. So, you know, you spoke about a number of things, whether Labour is ready, whether they can be trusted on the economy. You know, that's part of their story. But, you know, Liz Truss's mini budget, I mean, was that not one of the biggest kind of betrayals of trust we've seen? Boris Johnson's fall from grace. I mean, did those things not put you off the party?
When the Boris Johnson, Liz Truss debacle and then Rishi coming in, that really did, how do I word this eloquently, that really did upset our members. Mm. And it's not necessarily the petty party politics of, you know, oh, my favourite person's got in, but your favourite person's lost and all this. It's actually the fact of this is then delaying policy being taken through, the actual practical issues that matter to people, such as rising energy costs, food not being affordable, not being able to ever have your own family or have your own home because of the way that things are. That is what upsets our members. So, and I, to be honest, you know, you are seeing more people just become more and more disenfranchised from politics that are on the younger scale. But yeah, it's rather than the party politics of it, it's the distraction from the, you know, actually getting the work done.
So where do you think your members are going to go? Are they going to stay at home? Are they going to maybe reform? Some go to Labour, Greens, or have they just given up?
So in our polling that we've got out at the minute, there's maybe like one or two that are going to vote reform, which isn't surprising, to be honest, but mainly they are probably just going to stay at home. Mm. And some will still vote Conservative because... As I'm saying this to a lot of journalists at the minute, but there are kind of two or three groups of like Conservatives that are out there at the minute. You've got as well some people that will go and vote Conservative because they're parliamentary staffers in our membership and they want to keep their jobs, which is completely fair. We've seen articles going about how
that's what the Tories need to do, just hire 13 million people.
yeah, because staffers get a lot less redundancy pay than MPs do. Mm-hmm. And that's across the board. And then you've got
The Labour Party is interested in increasing workers' rights and improving that. Is that not appealing to you when you talk about staffers' jobs insecurity?
I think it kind of depends. I think more of what we see from the Labour's is the banning of the zero-hour contracts. And the thing is in Parliament, is that you can turn around and say, yes, you will improve workers' rights and you can do all this, that and the other. But what we often find is that because there is no concrete HR in Parliament for staffers, it makes very little difference because it's where do you actually go to report those problems? It's illegal to do a variety of things to your staff members, but they still do happen in Parliament.
Can I ask, I don't know if this is our final question or Ali wants to sneak one in after me. Is there a particular Conservative MP that you would like to see lead the party? If you think they would represent the youth Conservative vote?
At the moment when we've polled our members is Penny Mordaunt consistently comes out top. Our polling question has changed on this because before we used to do it very hypothetically where it's like, in an ideal world, who would you like to see? Where now it is actually on the 4th of July, if the Tories lose, who do you want to see lead? And Penny Mordaunt does generally come out top with Temi coming in behind her. So
yeah, her name is being branded out, I think, a lot, not just from young people. Thank you so much. That's Director of Blue Beyond, Olivia Lever, talking to us about this policy around national service. Before we go to our next story and our next break, Zoe, I want to ask you, because this policy sounds to me like the policy of a party that knows it's going to lose a general election.
Absolutely.
Like one that's never going to happen.
Absolutely. This is a party that's given up trying to fight Labour and now they're fighting Reform. Mm-hmm. They are worried about their vote splintering to this slightly more right-wing, older contingent of voters who actually think the young people of today never get up off the sofa, off their phones. So they've introduced all their policies this week have been in some ways punitive to young people. So crackdown on Mickey Mouse degrees, pensions triple lock plus. I mean, who's going to be paying that? The younger generations and national service.
And of course, Reform had a big press conference. I don't know if it was the launch of their campaign with Richard Tice and Nigel Farage. And the big thing that they wanted to talk about was barbershops.
Yes. I just think Reform UK's policies are all just pub chat. So it's like,
mate, I saw you tweet this and it's so true.
It's like, have you, you know, you're down the pub and you're like, have you noticed there's loads of barbershops popping up in our local area? Don't you think they're all money laundering fronts?
Do you know what it sounds like to me? You know when you go to the pub with your mates, me less as Muslim, but when you end up in a pub and you can hear like some 70-year-old in the background talking politics and you kind of listening and there's a lot of nonsense coming. Like the angst might be very real, like economic insecurity, financial insecurity, all that kind of stuff. But they're like, yeah, we should send them all into the army. They've basically taken that, put it on a platform, and now they're polling at like 15%.
That's people, it's populism. People love the policies they like to think they thought of.
Yeah, and what's hilarious is it's always, they always have this nostalgia look back on things that they never had to do. So national, you know, conscription is one. None of these MPs had to go through conscription, but nonetheless, it's something
they think
we should. We're going to pivot to the next story. It's one that we've already been speaking about, and that's that Diana Abbott has been accused has accused Labour of carrying out a cull of left wingers after reports emerged that she'd been barred from standing for Labour in July. We've spoken about this extensively, including listing names like Faiza Shaheen, Mish Rahman, Laura Townsend, amongst others who have been blocked from standing. Well, joining me now is Fiona McGowan, a former Labour member who was expelled from the party in 2022, who's joining us now to talk about this. Fiona, thank you so much for joining us. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your initial reactions to Labour's treatment of Diane and Faiza.
I'm sad to say I'm sort of at the eye roll stage of this sort of thing now. I mean, this is, as you say, it's a bit of a regular occurrence. And, you know, in many cases, there will be good reasons, good political reasons for people being barred, especially, you know, in these last stages when, you know, everything's quite urgent and you need to make sure that the wrong voices don't get out, if you like. And so you can see why there would be some sort of panic. But at the same time, as I say, this has been going on for ages. I was kicked out of the Labour Party in October 2022. Mm-hmm. And it was based on what seemed like sort of algorithmic decisions, just going through old tweets of mine where something was picked up at least 6 months before I joined the Labour Party. saying something positive about Caroline Lucas in the Green Party, and I said something else positive about Jenny Jones, also Green Party. I had been a Green Party prospective parliamentary candidate previously anyway, so it was already a known fact that I was pro-green and an environmentalist. I'm not massively surprised, but I think each individual case may have different reasons. So obviously, politically, it's quite incendiary to start talking about.
Let's tell your story. So let's focus on your story. So you were a Green Party member. You then joined the Labour Party, and in October 2022, you were expelled from the Labour Party for positive things that you had said about the Greens before you were a Labour Party member. Am I correct in saying that?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So we now have someone called Natalie Elphick, who was a member of the Labour Party. Very different case to yours, but in many ways very similar. I mean, she said a lot of positive things about Tories while she was a Conservative Party member. She's now sitting as a Labour MP. What's the difference between Natalie Elphick and Fiona McGowan?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there might have been a reason to try to get rid of me. I mean, I really don't think I was a major contender as a potential parliamentary candidate for Labour. I was about to throw my hat in the ring. I said that I would. I was at that time the only local person who was trying to go for the hustings to try and get that position. Everybody else was being helicoptered in from other constituencies. So, and I'd done a little bit of canvassing, a little bit of campaigning, but I was really quite low down in the pecking order as a politician. So I was very surprised that I was even investigated at all. I mean, I'm just a Labour Party member. And I stated my interest. I had been a delegate at the conference in October, and I got very inspired, particularly to do with the sort of green sort of incentive, the Green New Deal. I was quite horrified that I was under investigation. I asked why, and without any explanation, the next email I got said, "You're out. You've broken party rules by supporting another political party." And that was it. I wasn't even able to sort of offer my support for the next PPC. I wanted to help him campaign. You know, I was really ready to support the Labour Party. This is swing seat or whatever. It's one of the constituencies that was polling positively for Labour after many years of being Tory.
Fiona, do you think that the party were concerned that you might have a good shot at getting that candidacy? You said you were local. No one else was local. We know that local parties and local constituents like when their MP is from the area that they're representing. You are clearly far more of the left. You like the Green Party, are more progressive. Do you think your presence in that seat was a threat to the more moderate part of the Labour Party?
I can only assume so. I mean, I can't think why else I would have been expelled. You know, it would have been very easy for them to say to me, at the hustings, no, you haven't been chosen for various reasons, one of which was that I wasn't actually eligible. They were going to have to waive the eligibility because I hadn't been a consistent Labour Party member for long enough. So it would have been very easy to do that and kept me on. So yes, I mean, a lot of people I spoke to when I was on the doorsteps were saying, we'd vote for you, which is very nice. Potentially I was a threat. I didn't think I was, but...
Do you feel like then the decision to block you, if it's on those grounds, is actually pretty damaging to democracy? Because if people are saying, we like you, we want you, and the party decides in some way you're not suitable for what they want... You know, would you say the party is kind of blocking democracy or not behaving democratically?
Yes. I mean, I had already had my doubts about the kind of democratic nature of the NEC, of the executive committee. When I was at the conference, we were voting, the delegates were voting, and we voted almost, I mean, enormous majority voted to introduce proportional representation as part of the manifesto. And once the votes were read out, the NEC said, no, we're not going to accept your vote. Well, why did we even bother voting, was my thought. And then, of course, this, you know, not long later, I got expelled for potentially undemocratic in reasons. Yeah, I was not impressed.
And can I ask your own personal view? I mean, you clearly joined the Labour Party from the Greens because it connected in some ways, whether that was the Green New Deal or other things, with the kind of world that you wanted to see. Labour are on the brink of power, I think most would assume. How concerned are you that Labour are so hostile to anyone from the Greens shifting into Labour, but so welcoming and open-armed to Tories from the far right of the Tory coming across to the Labour Party? Does that concern you about the type of Labour government we might get?
Yes, but I think there's always nuance. I mean, I think there are so many people in the Labour Party with differing views. I do think there is a fear of certain kind of associations. Mm-hmm. And I understand the whole thing about the party line. And I was, you know, willing to toe the party line if I ever did get into that position. I understand you've all got to sing from the same hymn sheet. I don't like the way that it's distancing itself from its sort of socialist roots, and but that's very much personal view. Mm-hmm. Is it damaging to the Labour Party as an entity? I'm not sure if I'd really want to say that. Mm-hmm. I think I'm really optimistic, and I feel as though I want to give the Labour Party a chance. I want an opportunity for it to prove itself.
I find that amazing, by the way, because a lot of the candidates that I've spoken about who have been blocked, there's a sort of personal pain that comes with it, right? Because you've put yourself forward, which is a hugely courageous thing for anyone to do. I'm someone who's done it, and I always respect anyone from any party puts their name forward. Is actually quite a courageous thing, because you volunteer yourself for the spotlight and for the microscope, and they've kicked you out for what sounds like is really, really ridiculous reasoning. But you're still quite positive about the party.
Yeah, I mean, I genuinely believe that we need a progressive left of centre party. In this country, I understand, you know, we have a two-party system. It's not what I approve of. I don't like it. I will continue to campaign for proportional representation. You know, I would absolutely love it if the, you know, Lib Dems, Labour and Greens collaborated. You know, their policies are so similar, you know, mm-hmm. so fundamentally alike. And, you know, my belief is collaboration, and that's probably why I wasn't very popular in the Labour Party. Yeah. And indeed the Greens, mm-hmm. who were absolutely vitriolic when I left to go to the Labour, when I said, well, you know, one of the reasons I'm doing this is to try and push a green agenda with a party that's likely to win in this constituency.
Right.
So yes, I'm a collaborator. I don't take any of this personally. I was very upset at the time, but I wasn't like Pfizer, who, you know, obviously just put in her hot, you know, for ages and ages, months, if not years of her life into being this candidate and doing her very best, putting everything into it, and then getting kicked out at the last minute. I didn't have that experience. I was upset. I did cry, but I got over it quite quickly.
Right. Thank you so much. As former Labour member who was expelled from the party in 2022, Fiona McGowan joining us, talking to us about this ongoing discussion. How is someone like that not fit to be a Labour MP? I'm lost.
I know.
Help me.
I can't help
bring
you.
My ship back
know.
Into the harbour, because I'm wandering into the abyss.
Also, you know, she wanted to bring green politics to the Labour Party. I mean,
surely, I'm sorry,
only till about a month ago, that was Labour policy. It's just...
Yeah, I've got to say, look, it pisses me off when I see people like Natalie Elphick in the same party as me. Me and Natalie Elphick do not belong in the same party. I'll say that for absolute certainty, right? Mm. Now, this party might currently say I'm the one that's not welcome and she is. But to a certain extent, I kind of understand the benefit of bringing Tories in, because what you're showing to the country is that we're not tribal, that we can, you know, you're telling Conservative voters it's safe to vote for the Labour Party. You know, we're changing people's minds, particularly MPs. And I thought the doctor that walked the floor, I forget,
Dan Poulter,
I thought that was particularly powerful, because he's not re-standing for office. He's made it clear that the NHS was his passion and the reason that he's so for those reasons, even me, who kind of really finds it difficult to work with Tories, right, I see the benefit of it. Surely equally the same is true of the Greens. If you can tell the country and to progressives and to people who care about climate change and the green agenda that, hey, we're attracting Greens as well, surely you're showing a broader coalition.
Yeah, and I think there are some people who would say actually Labour is showing more favour to the right than the left. And, you know, Labour would be more accepting of somebody like Lee Anderson than progressives. And I think this speaks to this culture war that's going on a bit in the country at the minute, which is that, you know, the left and young people are kind of dismissed and thought of as secondary, and Labour has to do some courting of those people it doesn't like. But it is very unfortunate, and I think, you know, the Labour Party would be better for more people like Fiona.
And that's what we want to talk about to round off the show, and that is a little bit around non-traditional people getting into politics, and the kind of talent, and I use that word purposefully, the kind of talent that's missing from our politics. And speaking to us next, we've got Sharon Gafka, political activist, who's doing a lot of work on the topic of violence against women and girls, amongst other things, who is someone who clearly has a lot of talent and who should be swept up by someone in Westminster for public service. And I want to talk to Zoe, and I want to talk to Sharon, and I want us all to talk about the actual quality of the politicians we get, the quality of the political candidates we get, and what's missing overall. We're going to speak about that with Sharon and Zoe next.
Hey! FUBAR Radio presents
Access All Areas.
Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Oh, yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going through your head when you pushed out, I'm going to shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running round.
Except you wouldn't be 80 years old. You'd be 90.
I'd be 26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored. Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. The office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
Every single one said it's really necessary for them to come.
The Dating Show. I'm friends with a fair few exes, and I think you can be friends with an ex, but I genuinely do. But I do think that it's timing is everything with that.
I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you talking about someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like, if you've already shagged, you know, isn't that a bit weird?
Think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level of friend. You can be friends with someone, you can't be like best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff. But I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back to Politics Uncensored. Zoe and I have been talking about the Labour Party and the blocking of candidates, but we want to move on a little bit from that and talk more broadly about political activism and the missing talent pool, I would say, from Westminster and our politics more generally. Joining me now is Sharon Gafka, political activist who has been doing a lot of work, particularly around violence against women and girls. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking, theorizing, some of us ranting a little bit around political activism in the UK. Where do you think we're at, particularly with young people, with women, with people from minority communities? Do we have a problem in those kind of groups engaging in politics across the country?
Yeah, sorry I couldn't be with you in person today, but I think we do have a problem with them engaging in traditional politics. I think when, you know, I talk to a lot of young people, particularly young women, and it's not that they don't have opinions, it's not that they don't want to be politically active, it's just they don't think that the traditional form of politics serves them in a way that makes them want to turn out at the polling station. And obviously that is kind of what decides who our government is and how we are governed and what the laws are going to be for the next 5 years. So it's about encouraging them to, even if they don't necessarily want to vote for a specific party, at least turning out and spoiling their ballot as opposed to just taking a complete backseat, because I feel like that means that they are easier to ignore if they're not even turning out.
And what made you kind of throw yourself into the political world, the political activism world?
As in way back when?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm actually, if people don't know my background, I am the daughter of first and second generation immigrants. My dad is Polish, my mum is Indonesian, and both those countries have had a very colourful political history. And, you know, I've seen firsthand when I visit those countries what politics can do for those people that live there. And I always wanted to be part of something that was bigger than myself. I always wanted to help people and kind of leave the world a slightly better place than when I found it. So politics has been a passion of mine since I was very, very young. I think when I was 14, my long-term ambition was to become an MEP. Obviously, leaving the European Union made that extremely, made that impossible. But when I was a civil servant for 6.5 years before I went on to Love Island. And, you know, when people go on to Love Island, they have an audience of a reach of millions of people, because the kinds of people that watch the show, particularly young people, young women, in fact. And, you know, I didn't want to leave behind my passion of politics and go on to this new lifestyle of Instagram, even though I do use Instagram and social media quite a lot, but I wanted to use it in a completely different way. And I found actually that a lot of people found more trust in me than they do in traditional politicians, and that's actually quite scary. It's quite a big responsibility that I didn't realize I'd kind of accidentally given to myself. But I feel like if there are people out there that don't trust traditional politicians and who is going to advocate for them or who's going to help educate them and make them feel comfortable to be able to be physically present when it comes to politics.
Sharon, I find you really admirable, and I think what you do is fantastic. And, you know, you and Georgia Harrison as well, because she's done a lot of campaigning, especially in the violence against women and girls space. And I think you both have brought political activism and politics into a sphere, as you say, into a group that quite often it can be ignored. I wondered if you had any views on whether your brand of political activism is going to be the, you know, in 10 years time, is going to be the mainstream brand of political activism. Do you see more and more politicians taking to social media? Do you see more of these voices popping up from, you know, where young people get their news or their entertainment? I mean, do you think there is going to be a kind of crossover between influencer culture and politics sometime in the near future?
I think we've already started to see a crossover between influencer culture and politics. We know that the elections as they go on become slightly more and more presidential in terms that people are looking to the personalities of the people they're electing. We know that in the last general election, people were looking to vote for Boris Johnson as opposed to their local Conservative candidate because they liked his personality when he was Mayor of London, and his personality played a massive part in it. And actually, you know, I follow a lot more politicians on social media, like the likes of Zara Sultana, Nadia Whittam, because of their personality and what they post on social media. I think it does give them a very good reach and a really good connection with young people. I think one thing as well is that a lot of young people have a distrust of mainstream news outlets because they have, like, we all have an agenda, right? We all have our own viewpoints and we kind of push our own opinions. But I think that sometimes young people find with mainstream media, they kind of cloak that behind impartiality, whereas you know that if you come onto my social media platform, this is what I stand for, this is what I believe in, and you know that's what you're going to get. And I don't kind of sit behind this impartiality blindfold. So people look to that person that they can trust because it seems a little bit more human. So I do think that we've already seen that crossover, and we will continue to see that crossover as the years go on.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are looking, particularly young people. I mean, we spoke to a young sort of Tory organization earlier today, and they are saying that even their members are really untrusting of politics. I think young people who generally tend to be more progressive and on the left anyway are very untrusting of politics. So they are looking to some influencers to kind of guide their values and principles, a lot of young people. We're in a general election campaign now. I'm not looking for an endorsement on any party, but what's your view of what you can see?
I think, you know, I tend to sit on the left of the political spectrum, but I think right now this election is confusing for a lot of people. I feel like a lot of young people that want to vote don't know how to vote because that, you know, they think that this is the party they should align with, but then they don't tick off all of their boxes. So are they looking to vote more independent parties or smaller parties, independent candidates and smaller parties, but then does that split the vote? So I think a lot more young people, I am definitely looking at probably voting tactically in my constituency. And I think that, yeah, I think it is very confusing. When I have spoken to young people, you know, they say they're not going to sit there and read, I don't even know how long a standard manifesto is off the top of my head, but they don't want to sit there and read pages and pages. I mean, I'm 28 years old and I don't want to read any candidate's pamphlet that comes through my door. I'm going to be completely straight up and honest about that. But I've always said to young people to make it a little bit easier for yourself to like think about the five key issues that are really important to you and vote based off of that and look at what each party, sorry, my dog is just getting really, wants to get involved. But yeah, I would look at the top five key issues that are really important to yourself and kind of focus in on that, because at the end of the day, I think it's going to be very hard in this election to find a person or a party that's going to tick every single one of your boxes. And I think people, particularly young people, feel guilt or carry a lot of guilt that if they vote a certain way and that party becomes government and things don't turn out better for the country, they carry a guilt about that. And it's not down to you as an individual, it's down to everybody.
So speaking of policies, I know VOG is one of your major priorities, violence against women and girls. Of the two sort of main parties, because obviously we've got First Past the Post, it's probably going to be a Tory government or a Labour government. My money's on the second one. Who do you trust more, or which policies are jumping out to you as being particularly positive for the violence against women and girls space?
Yeah, I mean, I think I haven't looked at every single one of the policies. Obviously, the Labour Party had pledged to make spiking a standalone offence, and that is originally how my campaigning or political activism started. That's something that I've been a survivor of and I'm really keen to make happen. Obviously, I've been doing this for 3 years and the government have failed to make that piece of legislation. And obviously with the Home Secretary, well, the old Home Secretary's comments about spiking his own wife over Christmas, I don't particularly have any trust in the former government if they were to come back in with violence against women and girls, just based off their own record.
Okay, and can I ask you, you seem very passionate in this and a lot of the work that you're doing is great. I am often shouting at the moon that people like you need to get involved into Westminster, right? There was the stuff that you're doing on socials and leading young people and influencing people is immensely important. But we need people like Sharon Gafgar writing laws in Westminster. Are we ever going to see you there? And if so, do you have an inkling of which party that might be for? I'm trying to recruit you live on air.
I have said that my long-term ambition is to become a member of parliament. I think that the trust that young people have in me at the moment is to show that I would be a good politician, and I don't have long-term ambitions of throwing colleagues under the bus to get to a certain place. So I think that I have the integrity to make a good politician. I actually did say, I think in another interview, that if somebody knocked on my door and said, you know, I know that parties are in a scramble to get candidates on ballot papers, if someone knocked at my door and said, do you want to be on a ballot paper on the 4th of July? I'm not going to say no. At this current moment in time, I am a Labour Party member. So I think that if it would be more likely that I would be a Labour Party candidate as opposed to any other party.
Amazing.
That's interesting. That's, watch the space.
That's what I wanted to hear. And just a piece of advice for becoming a future Labour MP. The route seems to be through the Conservative Party, so maybe that might be something to explore. Sharon, that's brilliant, and I do hope that people like you with obvious, clear talent get more involved in Westminster, and we do have you on the show as Sharon Gafgar MP one day. Thank you much for joining us, political activist, former Love Island contestant Sharon Gafgar, talking to us about her political activism and campaigning. What's your initial reaction, Zoe?
I think she's great. And I really do think there are some really interesting women who have come down the influencer route into politics. Georgia Harrison, mm-hmm. Sharon Gafka, who do amazing things for raising awareness about violence against women and girls, but also encouraging women and young women to be politically active. I think it's great.
I don't want to be a downer. Right, especially at the end of the show, we've got 54 seconds. She would never be allowed to stand.
But you can make a difference from the outside.
Yes, no, you absolutely can. It's not be an MP or nothing, and that's the key. The sad part is I think she would be a phenomenal MP, right? Or at least from the limited engagement I've had with her, she'd be a brilliant MP, but just wouldn't be allowed to stand because she, I don't know, hasn't kissed the Starmer ring. Mm. That's the saddest part. Anyway, keep talking to us and keep tuning in as the general election campaign rolls through. More stories, more twists and turns as the election keeps going. I want to give a big thank you to all of our guests, Olivia Lever, Fiona McGowan and Sharon Gafka, who've joined us to talk about the various stories. And I want to give a big thank you to my co-host, the brilliant super Zoe Grunewald, who's joined us in the studio as well. Thank you all for listening. Do follow us at Politics Uncensored UK across the social channels, and you can join us next week. Salams.